The following is For Your Ears Only.
I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Exelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Back to Iraq. Obama orders new aid and airstrikes. Where will it end? Plus, Putin's counter-sanctions, Kerry's return to Afghanistan, and the Gaza ceasefire ceases.
Ebola here and there as the World Health Organization declares a global emergency, questions about new U.S. treatments and our preparedness overall.
The African Leaders Summit, shadowed by the Ebola epidemic, what progress on economic development, good governance, and public health?
The Invisible Bridge, that's the title of historian Rick Perlstein's new book on Nixon's fall 40 years ago last week, Reagan's rise, and today's too tangled politics.
Raising Her Voice, behind a debut CD by jazz stylist Gabriella Stravelli after shows around the world, one directed by cabaret legend Marilyn May.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For Your Ears Only, for the week of August 10th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Exelberth with a quote from the news. The biggest red flag of all is that Cybervore isn't trying to sell the data or use it to steal actual money. That was tech analyst Russell Brandon at TheVerge.com reporting widespread doubts about actual damage done by Russian internet outlaws in the reported biggest hack ever of 1.2 billion accounts covering 500 million unique email addresses. Now this.
This ceasefire has come at a price that is almost too much to bear. The fighting has raised serious questions about respect for the principles of distinction and proportionality.
The president has signed a decree which either bans or limits importing products from countries which have been taking part in sanctioning Russia over its policies on Ukraine. This means products from the U.S. and Canada, EU member states, Japan, and Australia.
When many thousands of innocent civilians are faced with the danger of being wiped out, and we have the capacity to do something about it, we will take action.
What a week. The price paid for a three-day Gaza ceasefire last week looked even steeper when Israeli-Hamas strikes and counterstrikes resumed after some 2,000 civilian Palestinian deaths that UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon suggested might constitute a war crime. Russia, meanwhile, responded to U.S. and European economic sanctions with trade bans on Western products. And President Obama launched flights to protect the Kurdish capital of Erbil and thousands of Iraqis trapped on a nearby mountaintop with emergency supplies and attacks on advancing Islamic extremists.
Also last week, Secretary of State John Kerry was drawn back to Afghanistan to reestablish post-election cooperation between rival presidential candidates. Cooperation at the grassroots was called into question just days earlier when a gunman in Afghan army uniform targeted the highest-ranking U.S. general to be killed since Vietnam. A lot to think about. And for your ears only, few help do that better than 28-year CIA veteran Paul Pillar. Now at the Georgetown University Center for Security Studies and the Brookings Institution, he blogs at nationalinterest.org and joins us again now. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Let's start in Iraq and the new U.S. campaign against the Islamic State fighters spreading to Kurdistan from across the border in Syria. Do you think the U.S. air missions against them were a wise idea and critical to preventing annihilation of the trapped Iraqis?
I think the action is justified. There clearly is a humanitarian situation or a disaster in the making with the minority Yazidis numbering in the thousands who are faced with a choice between starving on a mountaintop or being slaughtered by the militants of the ISIS group. It is also worthwhile to protect or to help protect at this particular juncture the Kurdistan regional government in its enclave in northern Iraq, which has been a rare oasis of relative stability and good governance.
How much further do you think U.S. military action can go without really returning us to the continuing Sunni-Shiite violence there, and how much difference would that make?
President Obama is clearly very acutely aware of the slippery slope danger, but I think there is a clear enough line that can be drawn between protecting the de facto state that the Kurds have in the north, and it really has been, in effect, an independent state since the early 1990s, and what amounts to, in effect, an external assault on that state by the ISIS group, versus reimmersing the United States in the intra-Arab Sunni versus Shiite conflicts inside Iraq. And I think the president is going to be very careful not to do the latter, which would be a big mistake.
Could Obama have done more in Syria to forestall the spread of ISIS?
No, and I think the president answered that question very well in his interview with Tom Friedman. It's simply fallacy to think that there was enough of a so-called moderate opposition in Syria, well enough organized and capable enough that some sort of earlier U.S. aid could have made a substantial difference.
Let's turn to the ongoing conflict and contradictions in Gaza. Despite Israel's seeming intent now on the destruction of Hamas, you say it implicitly relies on that enemy's continuing presence. Say more about that.
The Israeli government has no interest in taking over firsthand the responsibilities of governing that place, which has been beset by misery. It relies, in effect, on Hamas to be the police force of it, however much it is bashing Hamas in military confrontations. Hamas is also the major reason we continually hear from the Israeli government for not making more concessions with regard to moving toward a Palestinian state. And finally, I think the Israeli leadership is smart enough to realize that if somehow Hamas could be made to go away, its place would simply be taken by some group like the Palestine Islamic Jihad, even more extreme and more unyielding than Hamas itself.
Short of a two-state agreement or real loosening of Israeli controls on Gaza, do you think U.S. or U.N. peacekeepers could prevent or curtail more cross-border attacks and counterattacks?
There could be a role for such peacekeepers, but what's being thought about more right now is finding some way of getting the Palestinian Authority, led by Mahmoud Abbas, back into a policing or border control role. If they did, that would have to be part of a much larger agreement and understanding about the status of the Gaza Strip. And it would also mean the Israelis having to move back from their fervent opposition to the reconciliation deal that was reached between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority.
The idea of international peacekeepers has also been proposed for Ukraine's border, where Moscow by last week had moved some 20,000 troops and re-escalated Western fears of an actual incursion to protect Russian separatists. What do you think of that threat and the idea of a UN buffer force?
The main problem, military problem, that Russia continues to present is not so much the threat of an overt cross-border invasion, although that certainly is a threat we have to think about, but rather the continued assistance to the rebels inside eastern Ukraine and instigation of their activity. So I don't think a buffer force is in the near future for any solution to the current Ukrainian crisis.
Do you think, in fact, massing of troops could be Moscow's way of setting the stage for a subsequent retreat that they could then try to tie to lifting of sanctions?
The massing of troops clearly is a way of trying to increase Moscow's leverage because it does hold out this threat of a cross-border invasion. And so I think it is a part of what Moscow hopes will lead to a larger agreement that commits Ukraine to the sort of neutrality that would be the basis for a suitable understanding and would rule out something like Ukrainian adherence to NATO.
How do you assess the impact of Western sanctions and Russian counter-sanctions, notably not including the supply of energy that is really crucial to so much of Europe?
The Western sanctions are hurting economically Russia. The counter-sanctions seem to be hurting Russia also, at least as much as they would hurt the West. And as far as energy is concerned, neither side, neither the European consumers nor the Russian producers, would want to see those.
What do you see happening in the next few weeks and months?
There will continue to be a tightening of the noose by Ukrainian government forces around the cities like Donetsk, where the rebels are still holding out. I think the main question is, will those military operations by the Ukrainians be done carefully enough and delicately enough that it does not set off the kind of escalation that would be a stimulus to and a rationale for an overt Russian military reaction?
Paul Pillar is a 28-year CIA veteran, now with Georgetown University Center for Security Studies and the Brookings Institution. He blogs at nationalinterest.org.
Next, the war with Ebola in Africa and on the home front. For your ears only.
We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. There's lots more freedom of speech and public information online these days, and that's a fatal blow to a regime built on lies. That was Chinese novelist and blogger Murong Shukan after Beijing imposed new restrictions on China's most popular instant messaging services. Now this.
We think that the data are not as accurate as we would like. There may be cases counted as Ebola that are not, and there may well be many cases not counted that are. The lack of treatment facilities, the lack of laboratory facilities make it so that the data coming out, it's kind of a fog of war.
The company is trying to scale up on the production. It's difficult to produce these particular types of antibody cocktails, and it's not at the level of being able to mass produce.
The battle against an unprecedented epidemic of deadly Ebola virus declared a global emergency by the World Health Organization last week is hampered on multiple fronts. Inadequate public health services in affected countries hamper both treatment, such as it is with no proven cure, and reliable information about how the disease is spreading, as U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Tom Frieden testified on Capitol Hill. Distribution of an experimental drug being tried on a pair of American medical missionaries, now back at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, is limited by production difficulties, not to mention the normal need for testing safety and effectiveness over time, as noted by Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institutes of Health.
While U.S. officials repeat assurances that an Ebola epidemic here is not likely, it turns out that Emory is only one of four hospitals in the country with facilities best suited to deal with the disease. And most health facilities don't even have guidelines on how to prioritize the resources they do have in case of such an outbreak. Boston Globe reporter Deborah Kotz surveyed the domestic medical deficiency for a story last week. And for your ears only, she joins us now to say more. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
First, what are the most important facilities at Emory that made it the place to treat the two American missionaries, even before an experimental drug came in from San Diego?
It has a special infection control unit that is staffed by people who are specially trained in dealing with infection control with these kinds of deadly infectious diseases. So these patients came in, they were fully gowned, completely covered so that the patients themselves, you weren't able to touch them directly. They brought them into these very isolated rooms. When doctors went in to examine them, obviously they would be completely gowned up. And when they left the room, importantly, they would be able to disinfect anything that came out of that room. So they weren't bringing any of the germs outside the room. That was extremely important.
Even if a hospital had such resources, you say it could easily be overwhelmed by demand in an epidemic, especially if it had no firm guidelines on who should get the benefit of them.
Well, you know, it's a really great question, and they really don't have, you know, firm mandatory guidelines on the federal level that say this is who we should treat first. That said, the Institute of Medicine and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention both came up with these recommendations for, you know, looking at the flu epidemics. And so that is something we are familiar with as opposed to Ebola. And saying, you know, in the case of a deadly flu epidemic, how will you decide, for instance, if you have a limited supply of ventilators to keep people with an acute lung failure breathing, how do you decide which patients should get those ventilators? And what they recommended was that you should sort of be giving a priority to the people who are keeping society functioning, potential vaccine manufacturer. You might give it to police officers or the military force over, just women and children, for instance. And that's something that's seen as potentially controversial.
But experts you spoke with said some local doctors and hospital officials might find it hard to ignore those we generally think of first, pregnant women, children, the elderly.
Absolutely. And there's an argument to be made to be giving treatments to the sickest individuals or to people who are at risk for being the sickest. For instance, you know, in the H1N1 outbreak, pregnant women were getting far sicker when they were getting infected with the flu virus than the general population, and also potentially putting their baby's health at risk. So there was a priority to get pregnant women vaccinated. So, you know, a lot of this stuff is sort of done on the fly because you don't always know what you're dealing with. And that's why some ethicists were telling me that it's difficult to really set firm rules in place because every infectious disease outbreak is different.
An avian flu outbreak in 2006 led former Governor Mitt Romney to propose a special stockpile of resources. What was his plan and what happened to it?
He suggested and asked legislators in the state to appropriate $36.5 million to stockpile extra hospital beds, extra breathing machines, doses of medication, like Tamiflu, in the event that there was a flu outbreak. But his request was turned down by state legislators, and I don't think there are any requests in the pipeline or any plans in the pipeline to really implement this.
What do you think about calls to reduce testing time and expand the availability of experimental Ebola drugs? ZMAP from that firm in San Diego and AVI-7537 from Sarepta Therapeutics in Cambridge, not far from Boston.
Obviously, it's hard to argue with calls like that. You certainly want to get any potential treatments out there quickly into as many people as possible. The question is, it's not just a matter of financing, because I think there probably are folks who are willing to finance this, but it's a matter of, first of all, logistics. These drugs are grown on, at least ZMAP is grown in a tobacco plant, and that requires the plants, so you have to get tobacco manufacturers to provide those plants and the time to grow it. It's a complicated process. The other big question mark is just, you know, how safe and how effective are these drugs? They have not been tested widely in humans at all. I mean, basically only these two people, Americans, who are being treated now in Emory, have gotten this drug, and they seem to be doing better, but it's hard to say whether they're, you know, stabilized from the drug or from getting really good treatment. One big factor in Ebola, whether people survive Ebola or not, is how when the disease was caught, how good their treatment was, whether they were well-nourished before they got this virus. So it's hard to say how it would do in a poor population in Africa.
And what about the questions we heard at the African Leaders Summit in Washington about why the experimental drugs that do exist are being kept for Americans back in America when the need is so much greater, where the epidemic is running out of control? Should there be an exception for that whole area?
I mean, I think that's a great question. I think it's, you know, there are a lot of questions as to, you know, why were these two American aid workers treated before other people, you know, residents in the population in these countries? And I think that, you know, part of it, as Dr. Anthony Fauci had said, that, you know, part of it is logistics. They were able to get these medications to these doctors. The doctors were in the hospitals. They were already being treated. They could transport it there. There was a sense that, you know, these are American companies and they would like to treat American patients first, and we can argue about the ethics of that. But I also saw some interesting ethical issues raised today as well, that they were saying that if they had given these experimental drugs to the African population and these drugs had failed miserably, then there may have been critics who were saying, you know, you're using us as guinea pigs. Why don't you test this in your American population before you test it in Africans? Why should we be your guinea pigs? And there's a lot of distrust of the medical system in African countries because, you know, rightly or wrongly so, a lot of Africans have not gotten great medical care, and there have been some forms of experimentation on these populations where they say, you know, do we really trust you to be giving us something that's experimental? And again, the question is this drug going to do more help than harm? I mean, if you give it to a mass population without actually knowing the safety risks, how do we know that we may not be killing more people? So it's an interesting ethical question. And when you have a disease that's so deadly as Ebola, you know, it's difficult to say why not, if you have any kind of promise of a hope of treatment when there is none, why not try this out in a widespread population?
Boston Globe reporter Deborah Kotz surveyed U.S. preparedness for an outbreak of Ebola.
Next, more on that African Leaders Summit beyond Ebola for Your Ears Only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. I think he was mad and ready for whomever came to his door. That was Walter Simmons denying race was a factor after a Detroit jury found a 55-year-old white man guilty of murder for grabbing his shotgun and blasting Simmons' daughter, a 19-year-old African-American, as she pounded on his front and side doors following a car crash. Now this.
Ready, wall!
Justice!
From America to Africa.
Africa is emerging as a continent of just incredible youthful energy and limitless promise, growing at nearly 5% last year with a GDP of more than $2.5 trillion.
There were protests outside because of the dictators invited and singing inside before Vice President Biden addressed last week's historic Washington summit of 50 African leaders. Though shadowed by the worst ever epidemic of Ebola spreading out of control back home, the session was meant to support the continent's accelerating development with six of the world's 10 fastest growing economies and America's share of investment in it.
President Obama's promise that Africa would always have a reliable partner in the U.S. was backed up by a $37 billion pledge, including $110 million annually for a multi-nation rapid response anti-terror partnership. Major coverage of the summit came from George E. Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service. And for your ears only, he's on the line now with a personal report. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
While this is the first African summit, China has had several and has a strong presence in Africa already with its directed economy. What were the most important U.S. government responses to that emerging from the summit?
Well, I think you're right. Just not just China, European Union as well. And the thing about China being there is they go there, they do a lot of infrastructure building, a lot of highways and roads, and actually do the financing without the stickler democracy and human rights consideration. And so the United States' problem has always been, oh, we'll provide you aid if you say, oh, you're going to be pro-democracy. And China said, we have no such thing. So consequently, China investment in the United in Africa is about twice that of the United States. China, I think, has about $200 billion. So the United States is joining this thing late. And China is well entrenched there. But I think I'd be less than honest if I didn't tell you what business people in the United States see is dollar signs. When you see six of the top 10 fastest growing economies in Africa, they get rid of the old stereotypes of it being war and plague and all that, and now see this is an economic opportunity.
And what were the most notable developments in planned investments in Africa by American private enterprise?
Well, I think you have a lot of them already there. You know, Coca-Cola said it's going to help with water. But most of the investment in Africa has been energy related. And the problem with the U.S. is it's been only in concentrated in about three countries, talking about three out of 54. And so it has to be broadened beyond that. So it's nice to have these kind of conferences, but the test is going to be what happens afterwards.
Well, beyond the protests outside, how did U.S. officials and African leaders deal with that delicate issue of human rights and how less than stellar records on that score may affect U.S. government and business involvement?
Well, you know, that's a twofold problem. One is that they excluded about three countries, including Zimbabwe, and there were others they did let dictators in. See, and also the problem you have is, like Zimbabwe, I went there last year, and we have a complicated relationship. We say, oh, we have sanctions, and we do have sanctions on the top leaders for Zimbabwe, but we have an embassy there. We have an ambassador there. And so we've lifted some of the sanctions on some of the top leaders, and the EU has lifted even more. So I think we'll normalize the relationship toward Zimbabwe, but at the same time we're doing this public posturing, yet we have an embassy there.
While the summit was arranged to focus on business, some thought more attention should have been focused on the Ebola epidemic and the weakness in public health services generally in too many places, which actually does have an impact on economic viability.
Well, I think that came late. You know, the conference was already planned, almost underway when Ebola virus erupted in large scale. And so it's kind of hard to do that. But as you'll notice, a lot of our efforts already pointed toward health in Africa. When you look at the Bill Gates Foundation, that's what they concentrate on. So I don't think that you should certainly without PEPFAR with the HIV and AIDS. So I don't think that's something that's ignored. Health is a major focus of U.S. policy in Africa.
What about the controversy over the two American health workers infected with Ebola who were brought back to the U.S. for treatment with an experimental drug not being made available to victims in Africa where the epidemic is worst?
Yeah, that's true. And a lot of people are drawing that analogy, saying, hey, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for the people there, even though it's experimental. You'll take experimental over certain deaths, and that's certainly a legitimate question. But we're going to see what happens there.
Do you think President Obama's promised funding for a multi-nation peacekeeping partnership was sufficient to the continent's growing challenge from extremist groups, Islamist groups, other terrorists and gangsters?
Well, we see that illustrated best in Nigeria, I think. And so I think African leaders are smart enough themselves to know that they got to address this issue. And let's not forget, we have an African union there. So we have a union where everybody in Africa, whether you're a terrorist or not, I mean, whether you like their leader or not, are already involved. And so they don't need the United States to just convene them. That is an issue across a global issue, indeed, that we're facing across the world. And, of course, it has to be addressed by the African leaders themselves.
Do you see this summit and what it aims to achieve as President Obama's way of cementing a legacy in Africa beyond his African roots there?
Well, you know, the criticism is that he is TL Square too little too late. He is now just now doing a major initiative there when he's transitioned to being a lame duck status. And I can tell you from traveling on the continent myself, people were deeply disappointed because he thought, because of his African ties, Kenya in particular, that he would have had a more progressive or active policy in Africa, which he has not. He's late at this. In fact, there are some activists who say that George W. Bush, of all people, had a much better, a more progressive policy toward Africa. So he's still, you know, I don't know what is going to happen with his legacy, but this is, it will not be ignored that he came so late in his tenure.
And how do you think Michelle Obama did? Sometimes she can outshine the president.
Quiet as a kelp, I actually like her a lot better. I like him on a lot of these issues.
What about the logistics of the event itself? Obama apologized to Washington for all the traffic. Any major complaints you heard from the leaders or their entourages with all their different...
You always have that. You know, anytime there's a big deal going on in Washington, you have that problem. But that's the nature of the beast. And you also realize Washington is geographically a very, very small area. That's just goes with the territory. There's nothing you can do about that.
But the leaders themselves were pretty happy with the way it all came off?
Yeah, they seem to be. They seem to be. And again, the test will be what happens later.
Thank you. Georgie Curry is editor-in-chief at the National Newspaper Publishers Association.
Quote from the news, "What unites us is much greater than what divides us. Let's stay together." That was a plea for Scots not to vote for independence from Britain, signed by celebrities including Mick Jagger, Sting, Judi Dench, Helena Bonham Carter, and Patrick Stewart.
Next, 40 years on, Nixon's fall, Reagan rising in politics today, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. "We're going to have to work with other people to get it done." That was a call for bipartisanship by Tennessee Senator Lamar Alexander after becoming the latest mainstream Republican to beat back a Tea Party primary challenge. Similar moderate victories have been scored in Kansas, Kentucky, Mississippi, and South Carolina. Now this.
"I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first."
In the eyes of many in the world, this every four-year ceremony we accept as normal is nothing less than a miracle.
Richard Nixon resigning, the only U.S. president to do so yet, and Ronald Reagan starting his first term in the office after riding and reinforcing a right-wing wave that continues to this day. The connection between that historic going and coming and the two tangled politics of our own time is traced in the third volume on American conservatism by historian Rick Perlstein, The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan, new from Simon & Schuster. And to talk more about it, for your ears only, Perlstein is on the line again now. Welcome back to the program.
It's truly a pleasure.
Not coincidentally, we presume, publication of your new book was timed to the 40th anniversary of Nixon's resignation last week. But were you surprised that it also lands at a time that talk of presidential impeachment is again in the air, as well as conflict in the Middle East and charges of impropriety by U.S. secret intelligence services, CIA torture, and massive NSA snooping after the 9/11 terror attacks?
Well, certainly the impeachment thing didn't surprise me at all. I remember doing a radio interview with an NPR reporter who asked me what I expected from Obama's second term, and I said the Republicans will try to impeach him. And he was incredulous, and he said there's no way. But the fact of the matter is I've been writing since about 2007 that there are millions of Americans who don't consider Democrats in general and liberals in particular legitimate kind of partners in the governing of the country. That sort of extremism is one of the things that I'm tracing in this three-book series of mine.
Your new book actually ends at the point Reagan has lost his first bid for the Republican presidential nomination to Gerald Ford, who as an appointed vice president became the incumbent after Nixon's resignation. But you see that loss helping to recharge the anger and determination of conservatives previously pummeled in the Lyndon Johnson landslide over Barry Goldwater. Talk about that.
Yes, very much so. That convention is very fascinating as a loss of a battle that suggests kind of soon to be the winning of a war. Basically, to take it back, Ronald Reagan decides he's going to run for president against a sitting member of his own party, which hasn't been successful since Chester Arthur. And Ford is, of course, weak politically. He has pardoned Nixon, which is very unpopular. He has never been elected. But still, the pundits are like, this is crazy. And when Ronald Reagan scored well in a Gallup poll early in 1976, one of the newspapers ran it under the headline, "Has the Gallup poll gone crazy?" But, you know, he battles to basically neck and neck with Ford. He uses the issue of the Panama Canal. America's renegotiating the treaty. And Reagan calls that a giveaway to a tin horn dictator. And after Vietnam, this message he's giving, that his slogan was, "We bought it, we built it, it's ours," was that a kind of America was selling away its patrimony piece by piece. And that sort of patriotism was very compelling. Of course, Ford pulls it out in the end, but Ronald Reagan gives the final speech of the convention, and he's leaving the delegates in tears. And much like in 1964, where he gave a closing speech for Barry Goldwater in the last week of that election, he leaves Republicans saying, "Wow, maybe we chose the wrong nominee."
Well, a key part of Reagan's appeal, you say, even across party lines, was the honor and absolution he offered Americans after the shame of Watergate, defeat in Vietnam, and a variety of complaints about economic and social conditions. Say more on that.
I basically discovered, I don't think any other historian has really written about this, that Ronald Reagan's response to Watergate was always either to dismiss it, saying it wasn't an important story, or to say that, well, most famously, a quote that really kind of got a lot of attention at the time, the Watergate burglars were, quote unquote, not criminals at heart. Or sometimes you would even call Watergate a Democratic lynching, that the Democrats were trying to undo the results of the landslide of 1972, which, you know, kind of was nonsense because Watergate was this extraordinary movement of people from both parties coming together to investigate malfeasance, which was seen, in, at least among the elite, as kind of universally reviled. But the idea that Ronald Reagan was saying these things was seen as kind of a total impediment to his political rise. And what people didn't understand at the time was this kind of permission he was giving to his listeners, to the American people, not to worry, not to kind of face this big structural problem. The kind of riffs he was doing about Vietnam in 1980, his most famous line about that was that the Vietnam War was in fact a noble cause, was very attractive to people who didn't really want to do the hard work of reckoning with the morass of the 1970s.
How do you explain the fact that Reagan is now such a hero to the rigid Republican right when his own conservative rhetoric was often contradicted by compromises he made to govern as president?
Well, it kind of, there's a parallel in how he ran for president in 1976. Poor Gerald Ford, who was quite conservative, he got a zero from the liberal group Americans for Democratic Action when he was in Congress, was saddled with the responsibility of governing. And governing is not a profession for heroes. Right, so Ronald Reagan would always, you know, point to these compromises and say, "Look, we need a party that's represents no pale pastels." That was his line. And then, of course, when Ronald Reagan was in power, well, first as governor and then as president, he proved himself a very able compromiser, a very able manipulator of the process. But the fact of the matter is, Ronald Reagan was also very good, even when he lost in a compromise, to always kind of shore up rhetorically the idea that conservatives were right and liberals were wrong. He'd say he was forced into a compromise. Sometimes he would say he was forced into a compromise because his opposition was underhanded. He was always dividing the world into the good guys and the bad guys. Such that conservatives, who, by the way, often reviled him for not only his compromises but his refusal to kind of staff his administration with conservative movement activists. I remember George Will writing very nasty things about Reagan when he talked to Gorbachev. Really, we're looking for a hero. And if you think about it, who else do they have? You know, there's Nixon, there's Ford, there's Eisenhower, who was seen as a centrist. There's a paucity of heroes to choose from. So kind of almost after the fact, much like Kennedy for the Democrats, he becomes this larger-than-life figure carved in marble for the future.
Historian Rick Perlstein, whose latest volume on American conservatism is The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan, new from Simon & Schuster.
Next, a rising voice on the jazz scene for your ears only.
A last chorus for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. How sweet it is, how long it took. That was former White House Press Secretary James Brady, permanently incapacitated in the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan at the signing ceremony for the major federal gun control bill that bears his name. Brady died last week at 73, at which point the shooting officially became classified as murder. Now this.
I don't want to. Since the very first time I placed my eyes on you, boy, my heart says, follow through.
Waiting in Vain by Bob Marley is the title track of jazz vocalist Gabrielle Stravelli's debut CD. After performing in concerts and musicals across the country and around the world, this Wednesday she concludes a month-long run at the Metropolitan Room in Manhattan's Chelsea section, directed by cabaret legend Marilyn May. Stravelli also regularly brightens jazz brunches on Sundays for the restaurant Le Pescadeau in Greenwich Village. And to tell us more about all of it and more, for Your Ears Only, Gabrielle Stravelli is on the line now. Welcome to our show.
Hi.
So where were you born and raised, and was yours a musical family?
So I was born in Staten Island, New York, and lived there about until I was about 8 years old, and then my family moved to New Jersey. And it's funny, my family was not musical in the sense that neither of my parents are musicians, but they're both music lovers, true music lovers. And so they played a lot of music in the house growing up for me and my siblings, and a really varied selection of music, from opera to pop and R&B to jazz and big band and musical theater and sort of everything in between.
And when did you begin to think that singing could be your life or at least a career?
I always sang. It came very naturally to me, and I always loved it. So it's hard for me to pinpoint when I thought of it as a career. I guess the answer is always, in a way, because, again, I was lucky. I had really supportive parents. They weren't musicians, but they supported me in my pursuit of a life in music.
You've performed with Wynton Marsalis and the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, which sounds like a postgraduate course in that kind of music. What did you bring away from that experience?
So much. I mean, it's really amazing to watch Wynton and that band because they travel a lot and they play all the time, and yet there is still, I mean, they play with so much joy and so much passion. And they're so deeply in the music at all times. And that's a really incredible thing to be around. And the other incredible thing about that experience was, so the project that we did was a suite of pieces Wynton wrote called Abyssinian, a gospel celebration. And it really ranged, the different movements ranged from jazz to gospel to very complex classical music. So I think it was really incredible to hear this composition that took from many different traditions, but still sounded like this composer's voice.
Who are some of the singers, female and male, who most inspired you or helped shape your own style?
Well, Ella Fitzgerald, of course, was a huge inspiration for me. My dad really loved her, and she was really the main jazz vocalist who I listened to growing up. And then as an adult, I was introduced to Carmen McRae, and they were contemporaries and friends, I believe, and yet their styles are so different. There are many. I mean, I love Joni Mitchell. I love Stevie Wonder. There are so many artists, but those two ladies come up off the top of my head right off the bat as being really major influences for me.
What led you to a solo show with the honor of cabaret legend Marilyn May as your director, and what's working with her done for your performance?
It is an honor, absolutely, and it's been like a little mini university working with her. I met her because we both did one of the lyrics and lyricists shows at the 92nd Y about a year and a half ago. We were both hired to work on the Peggy Lee tribute there. So that was when I'd known of her, but during that show, I got the chance to really get to know her and watch her work very closely. And it's really hard not to fall in love with her. And she has so much love for what she's doing, and she brings so much joy to her performances. About a year later, I started coaching with her. I just went for a coaching or two to just work on some material. And I knew that I wanted to do this show, and I just couldn't think of anybody better to direct it. So that's how that happened. And it's really been transformative to work with her and learn from her and really go deeply into this idea of focusing on the lyric of the song and really how best to communicate and connect with your audience.
And after your final set at the Metropolitan Room, where will you be performing between Sunday brunches?
Well, I have some really nice gigs lined up that I'm excited for. Besides my brunch gig, I'm at Le Pescadieu in Soho every Sunday from 12:30 to 4. I'm going to be doing the cabaret convention at Rose Hall at Lincoln Center in October. And then I've got some nice regular gigs, Grasso's in Long Island coming up, Hillstone on the Upper East Side. You can find all the info you need on all those gigs on my website at GabrielleStravelli.com.
Jazz vocalist Gabrielle Stravelli appears at 7 p.m. this Wednesday, August 13th at the Metropolitan Room, 34 West 22nd Street in the Chelsea section of Manhattan, and for Sunday jazz brunches at Le Pescadieu Restaurant, 90 Thompson Street in Greenwich Village. Her new CD is Waiting in Vain.
I don't want to wait in vain for your love.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on Air is also online at iTunes, Feedburner.com, and Stitcher.com, and going back years now at archive.org.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates, exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, normally a major story on our show a year ago.
To mark last week's 40th anniversary of the only presidential resignation in U.S. history, we go back to the inside views of Nixon and Watergate that we ran 9 years ago when the Woodward Bernstein source Deep Throat was finally identified as former FBI official Mark Felt. From our June 6, 2005 Newsweek On Air broadcast with co-host Ginger Otis, Warren Levinson of AP, and me.
You can't have the guy that's running it going around giving out secret information. It's one thing for somebody in government to leak things, that's fine, but not the deputy director of the FBI.
This was always Nixon's worst fear, that the FBI didn't like him and they would go out to nail him. And this was one of the reasons he was motivated to cover up. Well, he might have been right.
There's nothing heroic about breaking faith with your people, breaking the law, sneaking around in garages.
Like many former Nixon aides, Charles Colson, John Dean, and Pat Buchanan had harsh views of Mark Felt. As Deep Throat, he brought their leader to shame and resignation, and in the case of some, like Colson and Dean, there were prison sentences in a painful resolution of Watergate. But try as they might to shift the blame for the nation's premier political scandal to its best-known anonymous source, the facts that some of us remember covering are hard to dispute. A paranoid president in a White House steeped in secret tactics and such a powerful presumption it was above the law or capable of corrupting it that it taped itself in the process.
Reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein were not always as close as they were during the Watergate days of the early 1970s or as they are today. But Newsweek On Air brought them together in 1989 to discuss the legacy of Watergate and the impact of a new TV version of their second book about it, The Final Days. And on the 20th anniversary of the break-in, we got the perspective of the late Katharine Graham, legendary boss lady of the Washington Post Company, which also owns Newsweek.
We started by asking Woodward his reaction to the TV reenactment.
Happily, in making the movie, they stuck
to the facts, and the facts establish the crimes, and the crimes are dealt with particularly through the tapes, which kind of become a Greek chorus in the movie, and you see what he said and you see what he did, and I think it makes it vividly clear that he resigned because he realized he was guilty.
Let's turn to Carl Bernstein for a second. Have your own views of the Watergate crimes changed as we've all gone through Koreagate and WedTechGate and Irangate and the rest? If all of what happened to Nixon, if all of these later scandals had happened first, do you think Nixon would have had to pay the price he did for Watergate?
I think what Richard Nixon did was unprecedented, and it was extraordinary, and you have to keep in mind that what he did was totally go against the oath of office he had taken to uphold the Constitution, and that we'd never had anything like that happen in our history before. And I think that this TV movie makes it clear the enormity of what he did in this regard. At the same time, and I think that would it happen again today, that probably the same result would happen, that he would have to leave office. That what the movie does, as the book does, is that it shows an empathic view of the man's human situation. Here's the first man in our history trapped by his own acts and reacting to being closed in on. And it's at moments it's very sad and compelling, just as it was in the book that we wrote. I think when the final days of the book came out, there was a view that that this was some kind of conventionally anti-Nixonian piece of work. But at the time, reviewers who really paid attention to what was in the book noted that it was extremely sensitive to what Mr. Nixon was going through, and was surprisingly empathic.
Woodward and Bernstein on this show on October 22, 1989. In June of 1992, to mark the 20th anniversary of Watergate, co-host Warren Levinson and I spoke with the legendary Washington Post head lady Katharine Graham about trusting her reporters and their anonymous source through the crunch and about the scandal's legacy on journalism.
In general, when you have a story that is very exciting, it's exclusive for about 5 minutes. And then everybody piles on, and it's not exclusive anymore. And with Watergate, it was exclusive for June to more or less the end of the summer. I don't mean totally exclusive either, because thank heaven there were a few other publications, the Los Angeles Times and Time, and I can't remember, but there were moments when people came in, which were of great comfort. And finally in October, Walter Cronkite did 2 10-minute pieces on the air, and that was a great help because it took us national. So what made the pressure of being alone on it great was that you thought, if this is such a wonderful story, where is everybody else?
Carl Bernstein has talked about being concerned about his personal safety at one point, and I gather you were warned by some friends not to be alone, physically, literally. Can you recall those feelings?
Yeah, I didn't take that too seriously, to be honest. What I did take seriously was the threats made against the company. And those were threats against our television station licenses that made our stock plummet. And then there were other threats. They cut off access to everybody in the White House. They wouldn't answer our phones. They wouldn't let anybody come over here to editorial lunches. They wouldn't let anybody come to my house to dinner, which was not exactly the worst threat in the world. but it was sort of total.
You've said any number of times that it wasn't the Washington Post and it wasn't journalism that brought Richard Nixon down. What was the role of the press, do you think?
Well, I think it was its proper role. The role of the press was to keep the story alive when they were trying to hush it up. Which was from the break-in to the first chink in the armor came when McCord went in and into the court, into Judge Sirica's court, and said yes, he had been paid to hush it up. And I think, I can't remember, I think that was in the fall. So that was our role, was to keep the story alive at that point. The thing that brought the president down was proper constitutional procedures, which was the courts and the grand juries and finally the committees of Congress.
10 years ago, a Newsweek poll found the majority of Americans thinking that Watergate could happen again, and some people today believe it has, perhaps even worse, in the Iran-Contra case. How do you see that?
Well, I don't see Iran-Contra as quite in the league with Watergate, because I really think that what was at stake in Watergate was an attempt to pervert the democratic system. I think that, in a sense, Iran-Contra was very serious because it was going around the mandate of Congress, and it was bad. But I don't think it was a perversion of the total system or an attempt to, which is what happened at the time of Watergate.
What do you think is the long-term enduring legacy of Watergate for the press?
I think that it is the role of investigative reporting clearly became more important, but I think that it was overdone for a while. I mean, I think everybody in the world, all the young people in the world, went to journalism school and wanted to investigate everything, and I think they overdid it. I think you have to investigate things. You have to be skeptical, but you shouldn't be vengeful, and you have to be fair, and you have to be careful.
The late Katharine Graham on Watergate's 20th anniversary from our June 14, 1992 broadcast, and before that, reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein.
Watergate, Inside Views, from our June 6, 2005 Newsweek On Air broadcast. Felt's identity as Deep Throat was revealed in a Vanity Fair magazine article on which he collaborated, in part at the suggestion of family members looking for financial rewards to help with their children's education. He died 3 years later.
Timed to this month's 40th anniversary of the Nixon resignation, in addition to the Rick Perlstein book, are two volumes based on the White House tapes that forced the president out. Former White House counsel and Watergate star witness John Dean calls his the Nixon defense, though he shows it was mostly self-delusion. Nixon once called the break-in like a comic opera, really, and nobody obeyed his order to have the tapes destroyed. The other book is The Nixon Tapes by historian Douglas Brinkley and Nixon archivist Luke Nichter. Among its nuggets foreshadowing the Perlstein thesis is Nixon saying many times, what liberals need to know is, if you lose me, you're getting a hard right America. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, more from Gabrielle Stravelli's new Waiting in Vain CD.
So they say, it'll rain a sunny day. I know, shining down like water. I wanna know, have you ever seen the rain? I wanna know, have you and slow, I know, and it can't stop.